It's a little bit technical, but here's the, if you like, the beverage curve. The dark points are pre-recession. The red points are after the start of the recession. This is the recession and then the beginning of after. Now, he did this analysis more than a year ago, so he didn't have the observation that, in fact, right, we moved back up here. He just had the observation that it was a jump up. He assumed that that jump up was a shift in the beverage curve. Well, what does a shift in the beverage curve mean here? It means that it takes more job openings per unemployed worker to get a particular unemployment rate. All right, that's what it means. So he just simply used this observation to say, well, what if that's true and the beverage curve shift up to this position? In other words, same slope as before, but just parallel shift up. Now, what's really remarkable about this little exercise is that we're now about at 8%, and we're right on this curve he projected. All right? So it was absolutely, he forecasted beautifully where we'd be. Now, the other two straight lines here are viewed as equilibrium conditions. That is, they represent the unemployment vacancy rate at which employers are just where the benefits to employing work are just equal to cost. So, equilibrium condition. And the estimate of pre-recession of where that was is the blue line, and that meant that unemployment was fluctuating. You know, it shifts around a bit, but the unemployment was fluctuating around there. But now, after the, if there really was a shift, that influences the incentives of the employers. If it's harder to find workers, that means the cost of finding them goes up. If the cost goes up, that means their incentive to hire them goes down. All right, having an impact on the job openings. And that impact is represented by the shift from the blue line to the red line. And he calculated what that shift would be using our model. All right, and parameters he estimated from that. And that estimate was a reduction in the... all right, so the natural unemployment rate here is where the system's tending to, which is the cross between the new beverage curve and this line. That's 7.5%. I'm sorry, 6.5%. 6.5 to 7%. Whereas this intersection over here is 5%. All right, so that's a 1.5% increase that I was referring to. All right, but we're still a long way from that point. I mean, we're about halfway between this point at the moment. Okay, so what's going on? Well, partly this is going on, or I will admit it. But it's not enough to explain where we are. So the other explanation is, all right, we still have deficient demand. Now, what does that mean? Well, households choose to reduce debt rather than buy current goods and services. That is, they're trying to deleverage, that's in the... If you were to read the financial literature, that's what they talk about. What economists would talk about, or the way economists would say this, they want to substitute future consumption, future goods, for current goods. They want to save, right? Which means, how do you do that? Well, that means you reduce your demand for current goods, right? Now, everyone can't do that at the same time, all right? That's the point. There's just a fallacy of composition. There are creditors and debtors. We can't all reduce our debt at the same time. Just impossible. So what's supposed to happen is the economy is supposed to adjust. How's the economy supposed to adjust? The interest rate's supposed to fall, which it did. All right? When the interest rate falls, that makes future goods more expensive relative to current goods, and that happened. It still didn't fall enough to stop this process. So unemployment took place. Now, there's lots of arguments. I mean, one is the nominal rate can only go so far down. You have to reduce the real interest rate further, you need a change in relative prices of future goods relative to today. That's called inflation, by the way. You need inflation, as a matter of fact, to get the adjustment you need to balance the demand and supply of current goods. Okay? That hasn't happened. Okay. All right. It should be happening. Actually, we should have an investment boom going on because employers should be anticipating this future increase in demand. And they should be preparing for that by, all right, providing the instruments by which this future demand can be supplied. Okay. What's wrong with that? It's not happening. What's wrong with that? Well, one way I express what the problem is that when will the future arrive? All right. Employers don't know when the future will arrive. If they knew, if they could guarantee it, well, you know, then they'd prepare for it and so forth. We expect them to do it. But this is the sort of basic problem with intertemporal substitution. All right, they're incomplete. We say that they're incomplete markets, but it's more than that. Time runs in one direction. Okay, so these facts suggest that expectations about future prospects were extremely depressed and still are. And it takes a long time to recover. It takes a long time for this, without some price adjustments that'll help along the way, it takes a long time for this deleveraging process to go. Now, is there evidence for this argument, other than superficial, or looks more or less obvious given our experience in the last few years? Yes, there is. Well, first of all right, here's the wealth effect of the housing market crisis. The value of real estate is the biggest asset in household portfolios. All right, it went down 40-50%. If you now look at what the financial wealth of households did, it declined 40%. And these are the pictures that each line represents a different age group. For the young, it went down less than for the these are the prime workers, or they're the age group. I guess it's 45-54. All right, these are the near retirement or retired households. All right, went down for all groups, more for some than others. All right, so that's a fact. Take that as given. The response to that fact we expect to be a reduction in demand. Okay, so the theory goes: a negative household house price shock to household balance sheets led to a sharp drop in demand for current goods and services, particularly by those households that were levered, that is, that had large mortgages relative to their income. Okay. Friction prevented price adjustments. It just went through that. The interest rate wouldn't fall far enough to balance the demand for current goods and services. Recent research uses the fact that there are different, across households, there are different households in different situations. There are people like me who don't have a mortgage. All right? I paid off my mortgage a long time ago. There are other households who have a huge mortgage relative to it. All right, so we expect that this effect, this reduction in the value of house price, and this leveraging effect, is going to have a differential effect on the, depending on what your situation is. So you should be able to, all right, distinguish between two groups, if you like. A treatment group, those who have suffered a big decrease in the wealth, from those who did not, and to see if their behavior was different. All right, that's exactly what Sufi and his colleagues did. He's at Chicago Business School. This is a recent paper, not yet published. And what did they come up with? Well, they come up with exactly that. All right. If you look at the set of households that were highly leveraged over this period, their expenditures on auto sales fell, upper left-hand side. For those who were not highly leveraged, there was very little impact on their purchase of automobiles, and then a recent rise. All right. If you look at durables more generally, durables being anything that lasts more than a year, same is true, although there's a dip down in both cases. Even if you look at groceries, all right, households with a lot of debt, all right, reduce their expenditure of groceries relative to households with very little debt. All right. So this evidence is directly supportive. I mean, just to make this a little clearer, we'll go into detail about auto sales because there's been some discussion. Auto sales have been going up lately. Well, it's been going up not because households with a lot of debt have increased their expenditures. It's going up because the ones without any debt have increased their expenditures. All right. Okay. So the argument here, of course, is that the deleveraging process itself has had a negative impact on demand, and that continues. It's going to continue until the process of portfolio balance in our economic language is reestablished. The consumer and private investment demand for goods and services continue to be depressed, but maybe they're slowly recovering. Some mismatch is there. We acknowledge that, but doesn't explain the majority of the change in unemployment rates before and after. All right. This is the little bit. How much time do I have? 5 minutes, okay. As I said, I wasn't going to get to this. But this is a very serious issue about the impact. We know from extensive research that a bad labor market has long-term effects on the employment histories, employment prospects, employment outcomes of young people. We can expect, therefore, to have this after effect on young workers that will go on. The euro crisis adds to the current demand problem for U.S. goods. I mean, I haven't gotten to Europe yet. I'm not going to have much time to talk about it, but I mean, the connection's obvious because Europe is a major customer for U.S. goods and services, particularly services, and so the problems in Europe only make the U.S. problems worse, not in any sense better. So what can be done about public policy? Well, monetary policy's acted. It acted, I think most economists agree, at least to stabilize the financial system, banking system, at some cost, we all admit, and some unfairness, we all certainly admit, all right? But it had to be done, and that was accomplished. But there's a limit to what monetary policy can do in terms of reestablishing this balance between supply and demand of current services. All right, it can't do anything more than drive the nominal rate to zero, and that nominal rate is typically the short rate at which federal banks can borrow, and it's almost zero. Of course, that doesn't mean the nominal rates that people pay are zero, but it can't do much about that wedge directly. Can do something, and that's what quantitative easing is about. That's an attempt to change the maturity structure of interest rates, try to impact the long rates as well as the short rates, but that's a limited ability as well. All right, so what's the alternative? Well, one well-known, since Keynes, alternative is to replace when private demand is insufficient to replace private demand with public demand. Now that makes a lot of sense. We look at it from one particular point of view. I'll get to the other point of view. One particular point of view is the federal government can borrow at the moment 10 years forward at 1.5% interest rate. Now if you were a businessman and you were offered that rate, I'm sure you could find investments that are more than worthy. In fact, you can make a lot of money, right? All right, so what does that mean? It says from a purely economic point of view, we should make, if the private sector won't make investments, that the public sector ought to be, all right? Just in order to make use of those resources. So that's one argument. Now, in its wisdom, the federal government has not been doing that. All right, there was, of course, the Jobs Bill 2009. There's some argument about its effectiveness, all of which is politically ideological. There's no doubt about its effectiveness. There's no doubt about it wasn't big enough. All right, they're just flat true. All right. But still doing the right thing, if you like, is politically impossible in spite of these record low interest rates. Not only that, but in its wisdom, the Congress had managed to get themselves in a position last fall, because they couldn't agree on raising the debt ceiling, they did agree that if they could not agree, that they would reduce expenditure and increase taxes at the end of this year. All right? And that's still hanging over the head. If they do that, it's going to have a very negative impact. All right? Estimates, increase of unemployment of 1 to 2%. All right? Well, maybe they will not do that, but that's here to be seen. Then there's a debate about, but you can't. We're already in fiscal trouble. How can you argue that we should increase the debt? All right. Well, that's really an argument which fails to distinguish between short and long run. There's no doubt that in the U.S. and many European countries, there's a long run issue of fiscal balance you need to address. Okay. But that issue is not the same thing. That issue, as it's argued currently in the political realm, doesn't take account of the fact that there's a short-term issue. We're not utilizing resources. All right, and that's part of what we're getting into, both in the U.S. and in Europe. All right, in an effort to do whatever, we pursue austerity policies. That's what's going on, because we're worried about the long-term fiscal balance. Okay, but the short-term effect of austerity is to have the wrong impact. It's to create more recession. What does that do? It reduces tax revenue. It increases, all right, certain kinds of built-in transfers like unemployment insurance, which increases spending. So it has just, in the short term, it has just the opposite effect of what you need. What you need is rising some growth to solve the long-run problem. All right. I mean, I just said what the European dilemma is. It was even worse in Europe because they now have institutional problems trying to figure out what to do with a common currency when you don't have either a banking system that's unified on the one hand or a fiscal policy that's common to everybody. So those are just adding to the problems. All right. So I end this note with a limited amount of optimism. All right. Left alone, the U.S. economy could move back slowly, too slowly, to some reasonable unemployment rate. But due to the political loggerhead that exists in the U.S. and now in Europe, I don't see that happening very quickly. All right. So it's not, as I say, my message is, unfortunately, it's the rainy side of the cloud. I don't see too much positive lining at this point. I hope that changes. Thank you very much.